This is a production of the Deucing Podcast Network made possible with a generous grant from the Open Society Foundation. Streets of Baltimore to the hills of Hollywood, it's John Waters' crazy, kooky, cult movie podcast. Sometimes funny, sometimes offensive, but always entertaining. Please welcome Mr. John Waters.
Hi, I'm John Waters, and welcome to my new podcast, Crazy, Kooky, and Cult Movies. I first want to thank Hunter for letting me have a show on his podcast network, and then a big thank you to the Open Society Foundation for sponsoring this podcast. As you know, I've been in the news a lot lately. If you don't know already, I'm here to say I'm straight, and I've always been straight. I know that might disappoint some of you, but guess what? I don't give a flying fuck. I had to live in sin for far too long, and for what? My millions of dollars? I'd rather be poor than to have seen and been a part of all that horrible debauchery. I started out as a conservative, and I wanted to make movies that satirized the Democrats. Pink Flamingos is about how the hippie Democrats are the most disgusting people possible. Harris is also straight, and he thought it would be funny to play a liberal woman in the movie because they were all ugly and manly. We were making fun of them, and they were too dumb to get it. Still, the left embraced my movies, called me a visionary. They designated my movies as cult or midnight movies. They played to sold-out shows in every college town across the U.S. And then the money started rolling in, more money than Harris and I had ever seen, so we just kept going. But the worst of it was that Harris and I are straight. We were actually accomplished cocksmen in the Baltimore area, but now we had to be gay to keep the cash flowing. For months, I tried to avoid having any sex with other men, saying I had a boyfriend in Canada, and we didn't cheat on each other, but that excuse could only work for so long. If you think having sex with a man is gross, you're right. First time, I vomited nonstop. It was one of the worst nights of my life, but that evil, demonic money had its grip on both Harris and I. We were essentially gay for pay. I truly felt that one night I had completely lost my soul. When Harvey Milk invited Harris and I to a party at his house, when we got there, the house was packed with all the prominent gay men of San Francisco. Drugs and alcohol were everywhere. About 30 minutes into the party, Harvey gets out a bullhorn and says, "Let's get this party started." At that point, he opened a set of curtains, and behind him was a room filled with young boys, none older than 10. At that point, they all grabbed a child, and then the fuck.
This program to bring you a special report.
Hello and welcome, everyone. I unfortunately come to you today being the bearer of bad news. At 3:45 p.m. today, my wife and former First Lady, Michelle Obama, was rushed to the hospital complaining about a pain in her lower abdomen region. The doctors thoroughly examined her and found what was wrong. I regret to inform you, the American people, that Michelle Obama has been diagnosed with testicle cancer. As I speak to you now, Michelle is under the knife receiving a orchectomy, or as others might refer to it, as a testectomy. After the biopsy of the testicle, the doctors will make a decision if chemotherapy is necessary. I just want to remind all of the men watching this on your TVs or listening on your radios, testicle cancer is not a joke. It can kill you. That's why I'm asking all the men to check your testicles for any lumps. If you do not know how to check your testicles for cancer, then feel free to slide into my DMs on Instagram, and I'll be happy to set up time and place to meet you and examine your testicles. I'll even check you for penis and prostate cancer. Then you can check me for these cancers too, because I'm serious about making sure these cancers do not take another life. Now I ask you all to keep Michelle in your prayers. Thank you and God bless.
Please stand by for further details. We return you now to your regularly scheduled program.
Shit, piss, and cum were everywhere. It was the most soul-destroying night of my life. That night, I saw the face of true evil. Needless to say, I was very happy when Dan White shot that fucking repulsive pedophile monster. Eventually, Harris had had enough. He told me he had enough money and wanted to disappear, and disappear he did. We told the press that Harris had died from sleep apnea, and they bought it. Now I was minus a friend. Maybe I should have went with him, but the allure of money was too strong, so I kept going. I was back to making movies and now musicals, which they turned back into movies. I was making more money than ever before. I was also more miserable than I've ever been. I missed the touch of a woman and was tired of living a lie. I only have so many years left on this planet, so I got to make them count. So that brings us to today, where I'm much happier. I've been banging women nonstop since I came out, and I've never been so happy. Sure, the Democrats now all hate me, and Criterion has let all my movies go out of print, but that's a small price to pay for happiness. The faggot era of my life is over. Now it's all pussy, movies, and podcasts. I want to thank you all for joining me on this journey, and I hope to meet all of you when I'm out on the campaign trail helping Donald Trump win the election in November. Now, as Hunter always says, let's get to some movies, shall we? Every guy loves a hot lesbo sex crime thriller, so I was excited to see Love Lies Bleeding. I got even more excited when I heard that a man was arrested for jacking off in a theater that was showing the film. Let's just say I was hard with anticipation. Unfortunately, my imagination was hotter than what I got watching this film. If you're making a lesbo film, then the girls have to be hot. There were no hot girls whatsoever in this film. In this film, if the girl doesn't look like a meth addict, then she's built like a muscle man. Yuck! With no hot gash to get excited for, I guess I'd have to try to enjoy the movie for its thriller aspects. But guess what? That sucked too. Kristen Stewart is just so unlikable that you understand where her father, played by Ed Harris, is coming from and actively want him to kill her. Let's face it, Trump was right about Kristen Stewart. The movie is slow and boring. When some violence does finally happen, it's too little too late. The only good thing I can say positive about this film is that it's a better She-Hulk origin story than that stupid Disney Plus show. When I left the theater, I opened up the IMDb app on my phone to see who directed this festering piece of crap, and to no surprise, I saw that a woman directed the movie. Now I understand why it sucked so much. As a side note, the guy who was arrested for jerking off in the theater actually fell asleep with his limp noodle in his hand, with no evidence of any DNA explosion. That's easily the best review I've seen for this movie. I give Love Lies Bleeding 1 dried up clam out of 5. For some reason, they made a new Indiana Jones movie, and I didn't go see it, so I asked my good friend John Grace if he'd go see it and review it for the podcast. He did some grumbling and then agreed. Let's see what the other John thought of it.
The one good thing about seeing the new Indiana Jones movie on opening weekend is that I got the whole theater to myself. I was able to yell things at the screen like an unruly black movie patron and not feel like an annoying asshole. Unfortunately, that was the best part of this movie-going experience. Let's face it, if I'm going to watch a movie starring an 80-year-old actor, I want him to be hurling racial epithets at every minority that's stupid enough to step on his lawn. Instead, we get a lazy story where the villains are yet again Nazis. I'll give the movie some credit, as it doesn't dress Mads Mikkelsen up to look like Gavin McInnes and his Nazi underlings as proud boys. The movie makes its biggest mistake by killing the wonderful Mutt Williams character off between movies. Mutt was the high point of the last movie. I remember being in the theater and watching him swing through the trees with the monkeys and thinking this was the Tarzan reboot I always wanted. I also respect Shia LaBeouf for denouncing that silly Judaism and embracing Christianity like most normal non-evil people do. Because of how popular Mutt was, I was always expecting the next indie movie to be a Mutt Williams adventure. I envisioned the movie would be Mutt coming home to visit his parents and over dinner telling them about his latest adventure. But you know how Hollywood is, if there is something good, they'll ruin it. And ruin it they do as they team Indy up with this annoying British woman named Phoebe Waller-Bridge. The best way to describe Phoebe Waller-Bridge is that she has the chin of Bruce Campbell, the nose of Howard Stern, the birthmark of Mikhail Gorbachev, and the body of olive oil. She's one of those grating, powerful women with no sex appeal they seem to put in every movie nowadays. What happened to the days of having a hot female sidekick with big jugs? We also get a Middle Eastern black kid who is supposed to be the new Short Round, but I don't see him winning an Oscar 40 years from now. The best part of the movie is Mads Mikkelsen. I'm glad he got a paycheck, but he's way too talented for this material. As for Harrison Ford, he's fine, but you can tell he's being doubled here more than Wesley Snipes was on Blade 3. I spent the whole movie worrying he would end up another victim of Kathleen Kennedy and Disney like Carrie Fisher, but thankfully he survived. Although, if Kathleen Kennedy and Disney want to get on my good side, they can kill Mark Hamill. In real life, he's annoying as hell, and the world would be better without him. So now that Kathleen Kennedy has tanked Star Wars, Willow, and now Indiana Jones, it will be interesting to see what Lucasfilm property she ruins next. It can't be Howard the Duck, since that's now back at Marvel, so it has to be Radioland Murders. I'm sure Dream On's Brian Benben will appreciate the paycheck. Indiana Jones and the Waste of My Fucking Time gets one Cialis pill out of five.
Glad the other John saw it instead of me, because he made it sound awful. Disney has fucked over so many home run franchises. They have a license to print money, but would rather cater their movies to a handful of angry loser Democrats instead of the masses. Those damn Shylocks at the Mouse House deserve to lose money year over year. Anyways, in a departure from the norm, Hunter from Hunter Looks at the Movies has asked me to play this piece for you. He said it wouldn't work on his podcast, so I guess someone's trash is another one's treasure. Let's give it a listen.
Hi, it's your beloved movie critic, Hero Hunter. If you know anything about me, it's that I'm a romantic at heart, and I love romance movies, and it's the one genre of movies that I can't get enough of. I love romance movies so much that I saw 2003's Geely 15 times in the theater. But romance doesn't just happen in the land of celluloid. It can also happen in the written word. Yes, reading books is stupid and uncool, but some stories have yet to become movies, so we sometimes have to lower ourselves and read instead of watch. Just recently, I've come across this short story that might just be the most romantic story ever told, and I'd like to read it to you now. Are you ready? Stuart Balk had always been a fan of Australian superstar Paul Hogan. He had grown up watching Crocodile Dundee and idolizing the rugged and charismatic actor. So when he got a job as an extra on Hogan's latest film, he couldn't believe his luck. On the set, Stuart couldn't take his eyes off Hogan. Despite the actor's age, he still exuded a powerful charm and magnetism that drew Stuart in. As they worked together, Stuart found himself falling deeper and deeper in love with the older man. It wasn't until a late-night shoot on location that Stuart finally mustered the courage to confess his feelings to Hogan. To his surprise, Hogan's response was warm and encouraging. Over the next few weeks, the two men began to explore their feelings for each other, sharing intimate conversations and stolen kisses between takes. Despite the scrutiny and judgment they faced from the public and the media, Stewart and Hogan's love continued to blossom. In the end, the couple decided to leave the public eye and start a new life together, away from the prying eyes of the press. They settled into a quiet beach house in Queensland, spending their days fishing and laughing and enjoying each other's company. For Stewart, it was a dream come true, to be with the man he had idolized for so long and to share a love that was both unexpected and powerful. And for Hogan, it was a chance to find happiness with someone who saw him for who he truly was, beyond the glare of the spotlight. The end. All I can say is if you don't have a brain boner after that story, then are you even alive? I get teary-eyed every time I read it. It might just be the greatest love story ever told. Hopefully someday this will become a movie so I can give it 10 loving kangaroo embraces out of 10.
Yuck! Have Paul Hogan instead hook up with Kat Dennings and her double D's, and that story is a million times better. Interestingly enough, my dream is to titty fuck Kat Dennings until I literally have no semen left in my body. If you're listening to this podcast, Kat, give me a call and let's make that dream a reality. Okay, this next segment is brought to us by the Open Society Foundation. Acclaimed film critic Roger Ebert will review the Sam Mendes film, 1917. Roger Ebert, I haven't heard that name in years. I wonder where they dug him up from. Let's give it a listen.
Anyone who knows me knows that when I go to the movies, I bring with me a notepad and stopwatch so I can time how much minority representation there is in a movie. I regret to inform you all that my notebook page after watching the film 1917 was nearly blank. First off, I only counted 3 POCs in the movie, and their screen time altogether was about 15 seconds. There is barely any POC representation in this movie. If I took my black wife Chaz to this movie, she would have thought I was a damn Klansman. She would have gone blind from the sea of blindingly white faces in this movie. Thankfully, a golden corral just opened up 5 minutes away from us, so she was too preoccupied to come see the movie with me. Next, let me tell you how many gay and transgendered there were in this movie. None. That's right, not one gay or transgendered in the whole damn movie. When I wrote Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, I made sure we had trans representation in the film. They could have easily cast that flamingly gay black guy from the show Pose in Benedict Cumberbatch's role, but the makers of this film would rather be homophobic monsters. It's bad enough that POCs, gays, and transgendered have barely any to no representation in this movie, but to make matters even worse, there is only one woman in the whole film, and not once does she champion feminism or declare that she is equal or better than a man. In fact, she doesn't even speak English. She speaks French to make sure that no one in the audience understands her. This movie desperately needed a Brie Larson type to swoop in and show the men how to defeat the Germans. But instead, we get another weak woman with no voice because she can't speak English. Shame on you, Hollywood, for making another movie catering to Trump, loving pro-Brexit. Neanderthal Republicans like my late partner, Gene Siskel. Yes, Gene was a filthy conservative who not only would have loved that shithead Trump, but he also would have loved this practically neo-Nazi propaganda film. But I, the king of all movie critics, give 1917 a big thumbs down. Somewhere along the way in the long run.
Drop.
On this podcast, from time to time, I'm going to interview someone who is important to me, someone who has inspired me and my films. As you all know, I'm a huge music fan, and my favorite genre of music is punk rock. But not only is this person a punk rock legend, he's also an accomplished actor who has worked with such directors as Barry Levinson, Robert Altman, and Robert Zemeckis. Please welcome to the podcast, Mr. Huey Lewis.
Thank you, John. I'm very happy to be here.
First off, I just want to tell you that the first punk rock album I ever bought was Sports.
It was a lot of people's first punk rock album.
So tell everyone how you got started in music.
I professionally started out with the band Clover. We started out as a psychedelic band and eventually a country rock band. We were mildly successful, but mildly successful don't put food on the table. I was in California at that time and the music scene was crap. So I went and moved to New York City and put together my band, which would eventually be called The News. Once we had a bunch of songs ready to go, we started playing CBGBs. At first, we were opening up for the Ramones, but after 6 months, they were opening up for us.
Were they pissed that you overshadowed them?
Joey was, but Johnny was cool about it. Johnny and I used to smoke cigarettes in the back alley and complain about how shitty Jimmy Carter was as president.
How do you feel having inspired so many punk acts that came out of the New York scene?
At first, I was angry. I thought they were all ripping me off and diluting my sound, but now I see it as very flattering. Not many people know what I'm about to tell you, so this may be an exclusive for you. One night, we're playing a show, and 20 minutes in, my stomach starts gurgling real bad. I just can't run off to the bathroom and leave my band out there holding their cocks, but I'm not going to shit my pants either. They were brand new pants, and they were expensive. So I do the only thing I could. I pull my pants down and take a shit right on the stage. The crowd went wild. They loved it. But what I didn't know at the time was that there was a young Gigi Allen in the audience that night. And he was so inspired by what I did that he created a whole music career around it.
I did not know that. That's an amazing story. Why don't more people know about this?
Here's why. That little shit director who made the Hangover movies got his start making a documentary about Gigi. Everyone he interviewed said, "You need to interview Huey. There'd be no Gigi without Huey." Well, that faggy douche never once contacted me, and he cut any mention of me out of the documentary. Just like Michael Moore, he makes up his own reality.
Now, you and The News left New York in late 79 to go out to Los Angeles. Why didn't you stay in New York?
We did all we could in New York. We were the number one band in the city, but we still didn't have a record deal. And New York was changing. People's tastes were also changing. Punk rock was waning in popularity, and rhyming blacks was the new hot thing. It was crazy. You'd have two black guys get on stage. One was thin, and the other was usually fat. They're holding zero instruments, and all of a sudden, the fat black guy starts making noises with his mouth, and the skinny black guy just starts rhyming over it. It was just god-awful. First time I saw it, I thought it was an elaborate joke being played on me. But no, it was real and people actually liked that shit. As you could guess, I got disgusted with the New York music scene. I figured if we moved to LA, we could get away from the rhyming blacks and finally get a record deal.
Once you and The News got to Los Angeles, how long did it take for you to get signed?
Not long at all. Less than 6 months. Thankfully, a lot of the music groups in LA were fronted by half a fag femme boys. We came in and played hardcore punk rock music and blew them off the stage. We were just a geyser of testosterone unlike LA had ever seen. Once word got out about us, a bidding war broke out to see who would release our first album.
Who did you end up signing with?
We ended up going with Chrysalis Records, and I'm glad we did. Our first album didn't do too well, and I feel any other record company would have dropped us, but they believed in us. Then our second album comes out, and it does better than the first. And needless to say, the third album was an absolute monster hit.
There are two things people remember from 1984, and they are Ghostbusters and Sports. And I hear you made a fortune from both of them.
You have to remember that back in 1984, people still bought records. The idea of the internet was still something only nerds jacked off to. Because of that, we sold something like a gorgillion copies of Sports. Now with Ghostbusters, that piece of shit thief Ray Parker Jr. stole the whole melody from I Want a New Drug for his Ghostbusters song. We took him and Columbia Pictures to court, And let's just say the outcome was them handing me a huge fortune.
Now, I know you never talked about how much you made from Ghostbusters, but how about telling my listeners?
The number is way too big, John. I will tell you this, I got all the profits from the soundtrack and 40% of the profits from the first Ghostbusters and 10% of the profits on all sequels, remakes, and Ghostbusters merchandise. I can tell you, I've made a shit ton of money off of this franchise. The only time I didn't make money is when they made that all girls reboot because no one went to see that piece of shit.
Needless to say, 1984 was very profitable for you. But in 1985, your career took a turn. You got your first acting role in a little movie called Back to the Future. For being the most popular punk rocker in the world, that is quite the switch up. How did that come about?
Bob Zemeckis calls me up and tells me how big a fan he is of my music. He then asked me to go out to dinner with him. I instinctively said to him, Bob, are you a homo? Because if you are, I'm about to tell you to go fuck yourself. He insisted that he was no pole smoker, so I met him for dinner. At dinner, he tells me he's making a time travel movie and would love for me to record some new songs for it. I tell him I'm not interested in doing music for some silly Hollywood film. I'm Huey Lewis. I'm as anti-establishment as you can get. If I'm going to be involved in a movie, it had to be as punk rock as I am. Bob then tells me his movie is punk rock because when Marty goes into the past, his mother tries to constantly fuck him. I was blown away by that pitch. The minute he finished speaking, I said, sign me up. I thought to myself that this could be the 80s, Where's Papa? I then pitched him a new ending for the film. My ending has Marty's mom successful in trying to fuck her son. Then when he arrives back to the future, the DeLorean opens up, Marty gets out, and he's now a retard. Bob loved that ending, but when he brought it back to Universal, Sid Sheinberg refused to make the movie with that ending. You know, Jews, always putting the dollar above the art. So as a consolation prize, Bob also gave me a role in the movie.
Your performance was nothing short of fantastic. It was so great that you caught the eye of legendary film director Robert Altman, who cast you in Short Cuts. How did that come to be, and how was it working with him?
It turned out that Altman was a huge fan of Back to the Future. I was told that he especially liked my scene and wanted to cast me in his upcoming film. I didn't want to do the movie because Altman insisted that I take out my cock and piss. I didn't understand why I had to show my cock in the movie. Just film me at my side and I'll put a water bottle filled with apple juice in my pants and squeeze it when he calls action. Altman was having none of that. He looked me right in the eye and said, you took your pants down and shit on stage. I only ask you to pull out your dick and piss. You will do it. I will see your cock on the day we shoot and I'll give it a magnificent close-up as it shoots yellow rain into the creek. So I just had to accept that the whole world was gonna see my dick on the big screen.
So how did it go on the day of the shoot? Did it go smoothly?
Not quite. They had me drink water nonstop because they wanted to do multiple takes. First take, I get my cock out and Altman just yells, cut! He then walks over to me holding one of those makeup brushes and he says, your cock is too damn shiny in the camera. And he then starts brushing my cock. It took every bit of my willpower not to fucking deck him right then and there. I mean, there was a makeup girl on set and she was hot. Why didn't he send her over instead? And then it was just take after take of me pissing. I think I drank 11 gallons of water and we did 52 takes all together. Once we were done, we had enough footage that he could have made the whole movie of just me pissing. I think he just liked to watch guys piss. He got off on it.
There was always a rumor that Altman was a golden shower queen, but I never thought it was true. I guess it was. Was your bad experience with Altman the reason you slowed down on the acting work after the release of Short Cuts?
It was. Hollywood is 85% faggots trying to take advantage of young straight men and only 15% art. I just felt my time was better used making punk rock history night after night.
It truly was. Is there anything else you want to say before we end this interview?
Yeah. This coming November, I want all of your podcast listeners to vote Donald Trump in the presidential election. The Biden regime has fucked up our whole country as everything is worse under him. It's time to make America great again, so vote red or our country is dead.
Amen, my brother. I want to thank you for giving up your precious time to be interviewed by me on Skype for my podcast.
It's been an absolute pleasure, John.
I'm proud to announce that I'm not only doing the podcast you're currently listening to, but the Doozing Podcast Network has also signed me up to host a second podcast. I'm so very excited by this new podcast that I recorded a mini episode to play for you now. Yes, it's a podcast inside a podcast. Give it a listen. Welcome to your favorite Peabody Award-winning podcast, John Looks at the Boobies, the most comprehensive podcast of female celebrities' boobs. Every week you send me requests of your favorite actresses, models, singers, and internet stars, and I rate their boobs just for you, the people. Now let's get to some boobies, shall we? Welcome all boob enthusiasts. It's your host, John Waters. Before we get to the boobs, I have an announcement to make. Just recently, they did a poll, and I'm happy to announce that no gay men listen to this podcast. That was something I was striving for, a safe space for straight men and lipstick lesbians who will let us watch, to enjoy and critique the female form. You'll never see me reviewing Dylan Mulvaney's flat chest on this podcast. That's a gay man, and no amount of Democrat brainwashing and bullying will ever make me think differently. Even he knows he's still a guy because he kept his male name. But enough about that fucking cracked out creepy freak. Let's get to some boobies, shall we? Okay, now it's time for you, the listeners, to tell me what boobs to rate. Let's see what you got.
Hey, John. I'm a fan of the movie Starship Troopers, and I was wondering what you thought of Dina Meyer's boobs. Did they give you a tingle in your bathing suit area? Let us know. Thanks.
I have to say, I'm not a fan of these boobs. They're small, yet still kind of saggy. I'm not a fan of implants, but some girls just don't have the goods and need a little help. Dina Meyers falls into this category. Her boobs would be way more attractive with implants, but I wouldn't go too big. A large B or small C would be perfect. As of now, Dina Meyers' boobs get a D+.
Mr. Waters, I think Sherry Moon Zombie is so fucking hot, she might just be the hottest chick on the planet, am I right? I personally would give her tits an A+. Do you agree, or do you think they're just an A? Thanks, brother.
Oh boy, we don't agree at all. Sherry's boobs look like someone cracked two eggs on a wooden plank. I actually wish she had nice boobs so that they could divert my attention from her bad acting. I will give her this. They are slightly better than Dina Meyer, so that's why I give Sherry's mammaries a C-.
It's Wang Chops, John Grace, and I just want to know what you think of Kathy Bates' boobs. So go take a good look at them, and you can't back out because it's your job. And while you're doing that, I'll watch this old Shannon Worry Laserdisc and stare at her boobs. Have fun, sucka!
Boy, do I hate you, John. These boobs are repulsive. They sag so much that it looks like they're crawling off of her chest. They are more disgusting than any horror movie I've ever seen. Because of her repulsive boobs, About Schmidt really deserved the title Misery, because that's how I felt after seeing them. Kathy Bates' boobs get an F-.
John, I love your podcast.
I was always a big fan of your film, so I'd like to know what you would rate the busty seductress Divine's breasts. They were pretty massive, and she had a lot of junk in the trunk, if you know what I'm saying, my player. Audi 5000G.
I don't know if you're trying to fuck with me or that you're just dumb. My good friend Divine was a man. I'm guessing that you're dumb because in your message, you sounded like the dumbest motherfucker ever. Please do the world a favor and kill yourself. Now no more of that boob and on to some real boobies.
It's your boy Sam, the Titty Master Hyde. I like my boobies like I like my wallet, big and fat. So that's why I'm asking you, John the Titty Sensei, to review my favorite bazongas, Alexandra Daddario. I think those udders are utterly amazing, and I hope you think so too.
Now this is what I'm talking about. These titties are practically perfect. If she motorboated me to death, I will have died with a smile on my face. Every day I ask myself, whose jugs could carry more milk, Alexandra or Abby Shapiro's? Abby has monster melons, so that it's even a question of how many gallons of milk each hooter could contain shows just how impressive Alexandra's breasts truly are. The other impressive things about Alexandra's boobs is that they look heavy. Those things look like they're about 10 pounds each. If I were to cut one off and hit you in the head with it, there would be no doubt that you would get a concussion. Everything about her boobs is amazing, so that's why I give Alexandra Daddario's breasts an A+. We're now at the end of our terrific titty adventure. I hope you discovered some new boobs to catch a glimpse of and others to stay far away from. But don't worry, my pontoon-loving listeners. I'll be back next week to review the boobs that you request. Until next week, keep looking at the boobies. If you have any boobs you want me to review, then feel free to leave me a voice message on my personal cell phone. Now it's time to give the Open Society Foundation some more time. They created this PSA for us. Let's give it a listen.
Hi, it's Kevin Smith. I know I'm usually the funny clown that amuses you, but today I'm here to talk to you about something serious, something that could save your life. Let's say your wife is fucking a big black guy in front of you. Don't! I repeat, don't! Go over and pull his cock out of her pussy and start sucking it. That's just bad etiquette and might get you beat up. That black bull needs to decide for himself if he's gonna come over and break you in. Just remember, big black bulls want consent too.
What the fuck, Open Society Foundation? Why are you spreading such degeneracy? Please, listeners, don't take that comic book nerd's advice. Thankfully, we have another PSA ready that actually gives you good advice. Scott the engineer, please play the PSA that I had commissioned.
Hey, it's your pal John Grace. I know a lot of you are thinking about choosing to be gay or trans. You think it's hip and cool and all of your dumbass friends are doing it. But don't. It's fucking stupid and you'll catch AIDS.
Now that was great advice. Thank you, Mr. Grace, for being the voice of reason. We call out degeneracy on this podcast, not promote it. Speaking of degeneracy, I recently caught up with a recent Oscar-winning film, and I think you'll be very interested to hear what I thought about it. Let's give it a listen. I recently caught up on the Oscar-winning film Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. I was interested in seeing the film when it came out, but life got in the way. you know how it goes. So I sit down to watch what I suspected was a zany sci-fi martial arts movie, and instead I was served up a disgusting piece of Hollywood gay propaganda. Only in Hollywood would you get this type of rug pull. You think you're going to watch Michelle Yeoh kick butt across the multiverse. Instead, we're forced to watch men stick stuff up their asses while they get beat up by Michelle. But that's not all. Yeoh's daughter is a lesbian, and like most normal parents, she doesn't approve. And because of Yeoh not approving of her daughter sinning against God, that has caused a rift in the multiverse, and the only way to save the multiverse is for her to accept and approve of her daughter's debauchery. One of the directors of this film is named Daniel Scheinert, and he comes off as the gayest man to ever walk the earth. Every time I see a picture of him with his constant soy face, I feel compelled to do a hate crime. You can tell his parents disowned him, and rightly so. It just goes to show how deranged and narcissistic the gay community has become, that they think us not accepting of them, putting their genitalia in the same sex as they are, that this will cause the end of existence as we know it. Spoiler alert. It won't. I now know why Jackie Chan turned down this film. If he starred in it, the CCP would have made him disappear just like Jack Ma. Michelle Yeoh isn't Chinese, she's Malaysian, so she was safe to star. I'm happy Michelle Yeoh won an Oscar, but I'll just pretend that it's a retroactive Oscar for her performance in the classic Hong Kong film, Yes, Madam. As for Daniel Scheinert, he's a blight on the film industry, and I can only hope he meets his very own Dan White in the very near future. Everything, Everywhere, All at Once gets 0 Harvey Milks out of 5. But it's been such a long time since I knew right from wrong. It's all the means to an end. I keep it moving along. Hi, 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 hi. You're one in a million. With this podcast and John Looks at the Boobies being sister podcast to Hunter Looks at the Movies, you can expect some cross-pollination going on. You earlier heard Hunter in the podcast, and who knows, maybe I'll pop up in an episode of Hunter Looks at the Movies. Hunter has been gracious enough to record another segment for my podcast. One of the most popular parts of his podcast is Hunter Helps Hollywood. Well, I'm happy to report that Hunter has recorded a brand new episode that is exclusive to this podcast. Thank you, Hunter, for everything.
Welcome back to Hunter Helps Hollywood. This is where you tell me Hollywood's problems and I supply the solution. So let's hear this week's problem, shall we?
Hey Hunter, this is Kevin from Los Angeles again. It seems like Marvel listened to you and canceled the female Avengers movie, but now they're planning on doing a young Avengers movie. Do you think audiences want to see this, or is it as bad an idea as the Marvels? Needless to say, Marvel needs your guidance desperately.
Recent Marvel seems to be the place where all bad movie ideas go. About 20 years ago, a young Avengers would have been a wonderful idea, but that was back when the studios made comic book movies for kids. Now they're all made for adults. Kids today don't even like movies. They've been raised on YouTube and TikTok and can't concentrate on anything that's over 10 minutes. So, Marvel will be making a kiddie film for adults, and when you make a kiddie film for adults, guess what audience you attract? Pedophiles, of course. And if you're going to make a movie for pedophiles, then you have to hire a pedophile director. You can't get James Gunn because he's now running DC at Warner Brothers. Bryan Singer is available, but he'll only show up to set about half the time. You could hire Victor Salva, but do you really want to hire the guy who inspired David Lynch's version of Baron Vladimir Harkonnen in his adaptation of Dune? That leaves Kevin Spacey, but let's face it, Albino Alligator and Beyond the Sea both sucked. You could always go with a first-time director like Bill Clinton or Bill Gates, but that's usually a bad idea for a $200 million tentpole project. This is just another bad movie idea, and it needs to be killed in its tracks, unless Marvel enjoys losing money. Now, if Marvel wants to actually make money, I suggest they adapt their 1982 comic called The Life of Pope John Paul II and get Mel Gibson to direct it. It's about time you show the people real superheroes instead of made-up ones.
When Black, The Little Mermaid came out, a representative of the Open Society Foundation contacted me. They wanted me to review the film. They touted it as the most diverse adaptation ever of The Little Mermaid, and if we didn't review it, they were going to pull our grant. There was no way I was going to see that film. I only have so many hours left in my life, and I'll be damned if I'm going to waste them watching Black Little Mermaid. I had no choice but to call John Grace and ask him to review the film for this podcast. After screaming, "Motherfucker," he reluctantly agreed. Let's see what John thought of the movie.
In the silence of my room, if I close my eyes, I can hear voices like a whisper.
I had no interest in seeing Black Little Mermaid, but when Mr. Waters asks you to do something, then you do it. I asked my son if he wanted to come see the movie with me, but he told me his time would be better spent working out and reading philosophy books. I opened up the newspaper to find the nearest movie theater showing the flick, but it turned out that all the white theaters weren't showing it. I guess they don't want any New Jack City-type incidents happening again. The nearest theater showing the movie was the Daryl Strawberry Theater on George Floyd Boulevard, formerly called Trayvon Martin Boulevard. I decided to take a taxi to the theater, as I really liked the hubcaps on my car, and would like to keep them. This would be my first time at a black theater, so I was curious what the differences would be. The first difference I noticed was you needed to walk through metal detectors to get inside the theater. As I entered the theater, I saw posters for movies I never heard of. One was for a romantic comedy starring Omar Epps and MC Light called What's Up, Biatch? And an action movie starring Lorenz Tate and Lester Green called Don't Push Me N-Word. Except it was actually the N-word on the poster. There were also posters all around for Tyler Perry movies I never heard of. The most interesting looking was Madea Goes to Israel. I wonder what type of hijinks she'll get herself into there. I then headed over to the concession stand, and not only did they sell buckets of popcorn, but they also sold buckets of fried chicken. They also didn't have a butter dispenser, instead they had a hot sauce dispenser. Instead of candy, they had sides of collard greens, mac and cheese, and pig's feet. I wasn't interested in any of that. I just wanted a drink. I asked to buy a bottle of water, but they said that they don't carry that. I then looked at what my options were. I only had two, Fanta Grape Soda or Kool-Aid Fruit Punch. As I walked into the theater with my large Fanta Grape Soda, the black patrons were hip-hop dancing in the aisles. I thought to myself, that ain't real dancing. Maybe I should show these shines what real dancing is. But then the light started to dim, so I found my seat. One of the trailers they showed beforehand was for a new, horrible-looking Pixar movie called Elemental. During the trailer, a woman stood up and started screaming at the screen, "Why is there no black elements? Disney fucking racist!" That got a chuckle out of me and a round of applause from the audience. Eventually, the movie started and I got my first glimpse of the Black Little Mermaid. I noticed that the mermaid's eyes were so far apart that she looked like a hammerhead shark more than a mermaid. Could she really be a hammerhead shark disguised as a mermaid? I thought to myself. But no, she really was a mermaid to my disappointment. The first song started up, and to my surprise, this was the same shitty song from the shitty animated film. I had thought they had blacked up the music, like in The Wiz. They hadn't. And this just made the movie harder to sit through, and not even the black guy in the row in front of me beatboxing to the songs was improving it. The audience then started getting angry once the black mermaid started catching feelings for a white guy. One black woman got up and screamed, "No you don't! There are many fine black men for your race, traitor ass!" Another woman then screamed, "Shut up, bitch! She only with him for his money, let that girl get that paper!" Then, another one of those shitty songs started, and I had had enough. Just for this type of occasion, I always bring my boombox with me. I had a CD with a mix of Motorhead and Black Oak, Arkansas already locked and loaded, so I hit play and let my tunes drown out that faggy Disney music. I thought the blacks in the audience would appreciate how I tried to improve their movie-going experience, but they did not. Next thing I knew, three of the theater's security guards had me in a chokehold. I then had to use my Gracie jiu-jitsu knowledge to break free from them. Once the security were on the ground out cold, a black patron started running down the aisle with a garbage can and then threw it at the screen. I took that as my cue to grab my boombox and get the hell out of there. It was only when I got home and turned on the news that I saw that the movie theater was burned to the ground. So, in summation, Black Little Mermaid sucked. Like they always say, nobody beats the Wiz. Black Little Mermaid gets 0 affirmative action hires out of 5.
You know why the Black Little Mermaid is unrealistic? Because everyone knows black mermaids have an extra bone in their tail that drags them to the bottom of the ocean. Thank you. Thank you. John seems to be a human shield for me when it comes to bad movies. But Hollywood will always make bad movies. Every year they release more bad movies than good. That's why we need to treasure the few good to great movies we get. That's why for my next review, I'll be reviewing the greatest movie of all time. A movie that was the blueprint on what society was to be, and not what it has become. And now, I give you my listeners, greatness. The year was 1984. It was early May, and Harris and I were browsing the selection of movies at a local multiplex. I was just looking for something to entertain me for 90 minutes. I never expected to have a life-changing experience, but that's exactly what I got. Once the movie started, I was enthralled from beginning until the end. As you have probably already guessed, that movie was Hard Bodies. Not only was the movie filled with hot chicks who showed their tits, but it was also two great movies at once. The first was a middle-aged man's fantasy come true as three single men over 40 buy a house on the beach so they can smash young puss. These guys have no game, so they hire the local beach stud Scotty to teach them how to get girls. What's amazing is these pickup tips Scotty teaches them genuinely work. If you follow Scotty's tips from this movie, you'll get laid a lot. I remember back in 2007, there was a show on VH1 called The Pickup Artist. The guy on it was named Mystery, and he looked like a fucking retard, and he gave out shit advice. His pickup tips might work in the bathroom at the Ramrod, but they don't work on hard bodies. When it comes to picking up chicks, Scotty is the pickup artist, not that fucking dork Mystery. What Scotty teaches them works, and soon they're fucking pussy way out of their league. It was Harris and I's dream to someday hire a Scotty type and go picking up hot bitches with him. Unfortunately, the lie of a life we were living prevented that. Not doing that will be a huge regret I'll always have. To put it plainly, I wanted to live the life those middle-aged men were living more than anything in the world. But enough of my personal regrets. Let's talk about how Hard Bodies works on a completely different level, too. Early in the film, Scotty is on the beach with his soulless ginger friend when a bunch of geeks and nerds, one played by a pre-Friday the 13th Kane Hodder, invade the beach. They have their dog jump on top of tanning women and pull off their bikini tops. Scotty confronts them and tells them what they're doing isn't right. Scotty is the good guy of the movie, but he is also a Chad. Not only that, but even though Scotty could fuck any girl on the beach, he was faithful to his girlfriend. He also stops sexual assaults and teaches other men that when a woman says no, she means no. The movie was teaching us that Chads were the good guys and nerds and geeks were the bad guys. 80s films were constantly lying to us, telling us Chads were the bad guys and the nerds were good. But here was a film that told the truth, and if we had actually listened to the movie, we wouldn't have male feminists sexually attacking girls, 88 different genders, and we'd have more than Marvel and DC films playing at movie theaters. Hard Bodies showed us the path to utopia, but we didn't follow it. You see, mere months later, a movie called Revenge of the Nerds opened and made these awful people the heroes. There was no turning back after that. I can draw a line from Revenge of the Nerds straight to Bill Gates screwing children on Epstein's Island. One begot the other. If we had only made Scotty our national hero instead of Point Dexter, our country wouldn't be in such dismay. To save our once great country, we have no choice but to have hard bodies shown in every school across the country. Let's teach the kids that nerds are evil and pussy is great. We will then build statues of Scotty in every major U.S. city because he is the perfect American male in the most perfect American film. This film is nothing short of an American classic and the finest film ever made. I give Hard Bodies 10 big titties out of 10 and also 10 American flags out of 10. Well, guys and gals, we have come to the end of the podcast. I hope you all enjoyed the first episode because there are so many more of them coming. For the longest time, I thought podcasting was super gay, but now I see the allure to it. Plus, if Joe Rogan can become a millionaire off of podcasting, then so can I. I can finally start making money that I don't feel dirty about. Also, to Harris, if you're out there somewhere listening, then come back. We shall be gay no more. It will all be about fun times and fucking hotties. Plus, you are the co-host I need for the podcast, and we can do a 60-40 split. I obviously get the 60 because I bought the equipment and started the podcast. Trust me, Harris, 40% is a good deal. So until next time, I want you all to remember that being gay is a choice. So choose correctly. Good night, and God bless.
You've been listening to John Waters' crazy, kooky cult movie podcast. I'm sorry to say that Mr. Waters has left the building. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here.
Been listening to a Deucing podcast production.